We're calling the EDC meeting of Friday, November 13th to order. It's 7:32 a.m. We'll do a roll call. Mr. Brown?
Present.
Mr. Graham?
Present.
Ms. Lapica?
Present.
Mr. Preston?
Present.
Mr. Brangle?
Present.
Ms. Moss?
Present.
And Mr. Neubecker?
Present.
Okay. You have a quorum. There was no one who signed up for public comment. So your next item is approval of the meeting minutes.
Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
All right, motion passes.
Opposed?
Next item up is the Madison Street Business Development State Funding Update.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Biden, or China finally congratulated Biden.
Lee, did you want to provide an update on that?
Yeah, was Chris Welch on the call, Rep. Welch?
Let me see. I don't see him on the call, no.
Okay, so I spoke to Chris Welch earlier this week. We're budgeted to get our funding, but right now the state's backlogged in receiving tax receipts. So once the state has the money, we'll get an update. I'll continue to ping them between now and next meeting.
Okay.
Is it possible that that won't happen at all this year?
He seemed to have confidence that we would get the funds. It's just the states, given COVID and tax receipts, there's been a delay on getting payments. So, my guess is hopefully we'll receive that in the next few months. But
can I ask what that money is designated to be used for?
Demolition.
Oh, got it. Thank you.
Okay. Next item of business.
Yeah, Lee, the next up is the discussion on the sign regulations, but I know there are a lot of people on here that were interested about the rapid testing initiative. Maybe we hit that next and then circle back to the sign regs, because that'll take more than a couple minutes.
Yeah, I think that would be great. So we have Kathy, Eric, and I have been working along with the First Presbyterian Church and CEO of Event Medical Solutions, Matt Skipper, to put together a rapid test event, which is going to be held next Wednesday and the following Saturday at the First Presbyterian Church parking lot. It is a paid event. You have to pay for the test. It's $175. People should get their results back within a couple hours. And we're doing this because we wanted to help boost the positivity rate in River Forest. Help lower the positivity rate in River Forest to contribute to efforts to reopen restaurants for indoor dining. The governor said once we achieve a rate of, I believe it was 6.5% or lower, that he would reverse and open up restaurants for indoor dining. So this is an effort we put together pretty quickly. Eric and his team, plus Reverend Paul Detterman from First Presbyterian Church, and Matt Skipper and myself have all been working pretty quickly to put this together. And we're hopeful that we'll get a lot of people tested. We can take up to 300 people each day. If you want to reserve an appointment for any returning college students or family members or yourself, you can book that now off the link that was sent out with the e-blast. And if anyone doesn't have insurance or the ability to pay cash, our provider has a partner that does take Medicaid and can get someone into a same-day test at a facility out of Chicago.
Lee, that 6.5% number, that's for the zone, right? Not for River Forest. It doesn't.
Yeah, it's for the zone, but we're trying to do our part to contribute here locally.
Understood. Just curious.
If we bring our, if everyone boosts testing everywhere, it will have a profound impact. And just as a side note, I had gone through. I found out I was positive for COVID October 29th, and I'm now fully recovered. But in my experience of going through this, I went to a state facility. It took me 6 days to get the results back. And what I had a fever like 2 days in, so I went to a rapid test clinic in Chicago, had my results in an hour. And what's important is, when people are facing something like this, getting results quickly can make a big difference. For instance, when I got my rapid test results, I quarantined myself in a hotel through day six, according to CDC guidelines. I returned home. None of my household members became positive to COVID. So, getting people timely information is important, especially with the holidays approaching. I'm hopeful that everyone will have their college students get rapid tested that Saturday, so that we can, save some lives and prevent the spread of this from impacting our community.
I have a question. Hi, I'm Sheba Chiplunker.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Who am I talking? Who was this? Who was just talking about the testing?
Lee Newbecker.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm an internist at Rush, and that's why I was invited to join this meeting. I had a couple of questions just to make it clear to the community that the rapid testing we're talking about is a screening test, not a diagnostic test.
Yeah, it's. I understand it has a 90% accuracy from speaking to Matt Skipper.
Okay, so we need to clarify that because, there's a difference between screening test and diagnostic testing.
Well, thank you for that information. I'm not a medical provider, so I appreciate your contribution.
Right, so we need to clarify that because we don't want people with symptoms coming, because when people really have symptoms and they have been exposed, then you need a diagnostic testing, which is the good old fashioned PCR. That's the only way to diagnose it.
And my understanding is that Matt Skipper has a partner that will do the PCR if someone is at risk for that and can make that referral.
Right.
So
screening test is for people who have no symptoms, who haven't had an exposure to anyone. That would be the general population. You want to be safe. You want to have a gathering. Then you just screen yourself like they do in LaGrange schools and other hospitals and universities. You just want to be safe. And then if you're positive, then you still have to do the diagnostic testing.
Well, it sounds then that the screening test would be the test we'd want to take anyway. So it sounds like we're on the right track.
I'm sorry, say that?
It sounds like in that case, the screening test would be the test that we'd want to take anyway.
Right.
So it sounds like we're on the right track.
Exactly. But we have to make sure we tell the community what the test is, because we don't want anyone with symptoms coming.
Yeah, no, of course. I think that's duly noted.
Certainly, if you wanted to draft something that you thought would clarify it, I could get that to Matt Skipper. He'd probably appreciate having further content on his website so people know what they're getting.
Yeah. Because right now, I think Melrose Park is doing some kind of testing on the 15th and 16th, but it doesn't tell us what kind of testing it is. It is a screening test or diagnostic. It doesn't tell us anything.
Well, thank you for that comment. I appreciate that.
Okay. Ali, is the cost of $175 covered by insurance, Medicare, et cetera, or not?
So he is not set up to process Medicare, Medicaid, or whatnot. It is a situation where you would have to take the receipt and submit it to your provider. And depending on your provider, they may or may not reimburse. I know I went to a facility in Chicago, which is Matt's backup, and they took my insurance and they charged it roughly $175 and it was paid for in full. But yeah, I was more concerned about getting the access. When I tried to get a rapid test off CVS, they had no appointment slots for 3 days. And at that point in time, the whole point of rapid testing goes out the window because you're better off getting a PCR test. So, you know, boosting the availability of testing and making that available as college students are returning home will hopefully, you know, help protect some families from having transmission from their loved ones.
So I have something to say about that. So you can use your insurances for these testing. You don't need a doctor's order, and you can use your HSA, FSA for these things.
Yeah, but I know that Matt Skipper is providing a receipt, but he's not set up to be able to do the reimbursement.
Right.
But he could probably do the HSA is what she was saying.
Yeah.
He should be able to take the...
Presumably, you know, I don't want to comment on something I'm not an expert on. Anymore.
Right. So generally, for all testing, that's what you can do.
Yeah. Thank you.
Lee, can I ask, do we know what the current positivity rate is for River Forest?
Give me a moment. I can check that. I usually look at that every day. I've been running a little bit behind recovering from this and trying to take care of
it. Around 7 point something last I checked.
Right. I think we were under 10%.
Yeah, it was around 7 point something. The last it came out.
Northwestern University posted 11% on the 7-day rolling average yesterday.
Very good. Okay. And is Matt Skipper on the call? Yeah, okay, so in any event, the link, if you signed up for the Village of River Forest, the alerts, the link was sent out to everyone, and we'll move on to the next item of business. And so, okay, so we're going, Eric, did you want to revert back to item 4, the Madison Street, or 5, the sign regulations?
Correct. Yeah, we've discussed 4. We've discussed number 7 now, so we'll jump back to 5 and talk about changes to the village's sign regulations. So on the call with me today is Lisa Shiner. Lisa's the assistant village administrator. She's been running point on these changes. We proposed, based on some recent case law, the village is required to make some changes to its sign regulations. So we've been working with Hauziel Levine, who's our planning consultant, in developing these. So we ran these in front of the village board this past Monday night, had a good discussion, and informed them we wanted to get the EDC input, primarily because a lot of these regulations will affect, potentially affect the business community. And so we wanted to get all of your input. And so with that, I'm going to switch it over to Lisa, who has a quick PowerPoint, and we'll run you through on a high level what these changes look like.
Sure. Good morning, Chairman Neubecker and everybody at the EDC. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you this morning about the sign ordinance amendments. The goal today is to just, as Eric mentioned, walk you through the issue and take your feedback. We had a discussion with the board Monday night, and that's they referred this matter over to you. They raised some great questions, and I anticipate we'll have the same conversation today. So let me just share my screen with you. Give me 1 second to pull that up. All right, so the sign ordinance went through its last major overhaul in 2011. And since that time, as Eric mentioned, there was a Supreme Court ruling that made all content-based regulations unenforceable. And through our experience in administering the sign ordinance since it was last updated, we found language and regulations that would benefit from some clarification and updating. As Eric mentioned, we've worked with Jackie Wells of Hauziel Levine's firm as well as John Housiel. Jackie wasn't able to be on the call, but we do have John available to answer any questions that you have. So there was a Supreme Court ruling in the case of Reed v. Gilbert that rendered content-based regulations unenforceable. And the rule of thumb that we use to determine whether or not it's a content-based regulation is that if we have to read the sign, then in order to determine whether or not it complies with our regulations, then that's a regulation that would likely be subject to challenge. The only place where we still retain the ability to do some control over content is in directional signage, which is literally just used to direct pedestrians and drivers throughout a site. So we can still regulate that to a degree. The other thing we can still regulate is sign type, location, quantity, size, illumination, and whether or not they can be installed with or without a permit. The sign ordinance includes two really broad categories of signs: signs that can't be installed anywhere or prohibited signs, and signs that can be installed some in residential districts, but primarily in commercial districts with or without a permit. So just real quickly, I wanted to give you a rundown on the amended ordinance and what remains a prohibited sign in River Forest. We've got the list here. All the content-based regulations have been removed from the section of the ordinance that deals with prohibited signs, and this is what we're left with. Other than content-based regulations, there's only one material change to the list of prohibited signs, and that is to define and prohibit outline lighting. I've got a visual example here of what outline lighting is. There's been some question internally when we're administering the sign ordinance as to whether or not outline lighting is considered an attention-getting device. Attention-getting devices are prohibited, but outline lighting wasn't something that was specifically contemplated or prohibited in the code. So in order to provide clarity on this item and to achieve a certain aesthetic in the village's commercial corridors, we're recommending that this type of outline lighting be prohibited. This type of signage is defined in a way that will ensure that whether it's attached to the window or some other element, if it's viewable from the outside, it will be prohibited.
You're setting me.
In addition to signs that are allowed. I think we're picking up a little bit of background noise. In addition to signs that are allowed without a permit, I just wanted to give you a quick reference table of which signs are allowed per commercial district and within the PRI zoning district. PRI stands for public, recreational, and institutional. So the churches and schools and universities and government properties are all zoned PRI. I would just note that the C1 district is essentially North Avenue. And on North Avenue, you can have one monument sign or one pylon sign, but not both. The C2 district encompasses Madison Street. The PRI, as I mentioned earlier, is scattered throughout the community. On this table, we've introduced two sign types called a projecting sign and a sandwich board sign, which I'll walk you through in just a moment. And in all zoning districts, anytime where you see something with two asterisks, those indicate signs that are allowed only as part of an approved plan development. So to go back to our broad categories, we talked about prohibited signs, and now we're talking about signs that are permitted, but they don't require a permit from the building department in order to install them. Again, we've removed all content-based regulations from this section of the ordinance. Previously, the ordinance included categories of signs such as real estate signs, political signs, and residential private sale signs. Those all fell into the category of content-based regulations, and so we had to remove that language. Removing the language would have the effect of prohibiting all of these sign types in the village. And that really isn't our intent. Our intent is to really come into compliance with the Supreme Court ruling, but still allow residents to post real estate signs, for example, yard signs supporting their favorite local charity or even a political candidate. And while we can't regulate what the sign says, we can work to accommodate these types of signs. So in lieu of real estate signs, we have installed a definition, or John helped create a definition of something called post signs. And we have a depiction of that on the left-hand side of the screen here. Post signs, as you see, are what you would typically see for a realtor. Now we can't control that only realtors use those or that they only advertise real estate listings, but we can limit their installation to one per lot in a period of 180 days. if for some reason someone needs to leave that post sign up longer than 180 days, then the zoning administrator has the authority to extend that timeline if needed. Similarly, to the content-based regulation and discussion around post signs, the sign ordinance currently has a category of signs called political signs and private residential sale signs, both of which are prohibited under the new Supreme Court ruling. So we've introduced a category called yard signs, and they're depicted on the right-hand side of your screen. The regulations that we're proposing would limit the number of yard signs to 4 at a time on any residential property. But there would be no length on the time limit that they can be displayed. So again, we can't regulate content and what's on the sign, but the intent here is to find a path forward to allow this type of a sign rather than to just strictly prohibit it. As noted earlier, we can continue to allow and regulate on-site traffic directional signs and temporary window signs. We've got a depiction of what an on-site directional sign will look like under the new regulations and what those size restrictions are. And we're going to talk a little bit more in depth about window signs, but here without a permit, you can install a temporary window sign. Window signs in general will be limited to 25% of the window frame. And again, we'll talk about that a little bit more specifically, but here you'll see there's a maximum of 30% of any individual window frame. So in other words, your permanent sign can take up 25% of your window frame, and then you're allowed another 5% to accommodate temporary signage. Finally, in the category of signs that don't require permits, we're proposing that sandwich board signs be allowed specifically within the C3 district, which is Lake Street. And we think that allowing these will help the types of businesses that are locating on Lake Street not only advertise their goods and services, but would also contribute to a pedestrian-friendly and downtown environment. At the village board meeting Monday night, there was a really good question raised about sandwich board sign use in the PRI district. I know, for example, Concordia will use, you know, parking available here with an arrow on the days of special events when they do have those special events. So we're talking about updating what we're proposing to allow sandwich board signs for the use of traffic directional purposes, or to allow sandwich board signs within the PRI. So that is one change that would be proposed back to the board that you just haven't seen yet. So moving on to the category of signs that do require permits, we've got a list here. Again, these are all signs that are already included in the sign ordinance. The only definition here is window signs. Each of these signs is not just regulated in terms of size sign type, excuse me, but also in terms of height, lighting, location, and size. Awning and canopy signs are currently allowed and will continue to be allowed in all commercial zoning districts subject to size, area, and height restrictions. And we're not proposing any changes to those restrictions under the proposed amendments. Monument signs are also currently allowed and will continue to be allowed subject to size, area, setback, height, and lighting restrictions. And again, we're not proposing that any of those change under the amended ordinance. We did mention one type of new sign a little bit earlier called a projecting sign. And again, this is in order to create an appealing pedestrian environment so that as people are walking down the street, they're able to see what tenant or what shop they're in front of. And so we're proposing a section for a type of sign called a projecting sign, which you may have also heard in the past referred to as a blade sign. And we're proposing that they be allowed in the C3 district on Lake Street as of right and in the ORIC district as part of a planned development. So in other words, Town Center would be able to use this type of sign to advertise their different tenants. Because they're already under a planned development. The sign ordinance currently contains a category of signage called gas station price sign, and that really amounts to a content-based regulation, so we're not able to leave that language in the code. Instead, we've introduced an amendment to identify a new sign type called a pylon sign, which you see depicted here. Under the proposed amendment, pylon signs will only be allowed in the C1 zoning district, and they may not exceed 20 feet in height or 80 square feet per sign face in area. Further, they must be set back from the right-of-way and property line and can't block site triangles for motorists so that we don't have any dangerous situations due to visibility being blocked. The sign ordinance allows and continues to allow wall signs, provided the letters are individually affixed to the building and are subject to size restrictions. One point John raised with the Village Board Monday, and that's worth noting here, is that when we say letters have to be individually affixed, you know, obviously we understand that building owners and tenants don't necessarily want to turn their walls into Swiss cheese. So rather than drilling each letter individually into the building, they can be mounted to some sort of backing, and then that backing can be attached to the building to limit the number of holes that people are putting in the facade.
And a good example of this too, if you're looking for a real life example, they did something similar to this at Loyola Gottlieb along North Avenue, where the letters are individual in nature, but attached to another material conduit, et cetera, that is attached to the wall, as Lisa pointed out, instead of drilling individual holes in the wall for each individual letter.
So just staying for a moment then on window signs and permanent window signs, the sign ordinance modifications clarify that permanent window signs are allowed, but anything that's more than 50% opaque and contains copy will count toward the overall amount of signage that is allowed on any particular site. We are proposing that window signs be limited to 25% of the window frame. And as I mentioned earlier, an additional 5% would be allowed for any temporary signage. 50% opaque vinyl decals can be applied to provide privacy for clients and customers, and it would not count towards signage if it doesn't contain copy. So as you go past different salons or exercise facilities, they can use some sort of vinyl window film or essentially something that creates the look of a frosted window for privacy for the clients inside the shop. One area where we're proposing an amendment has to do with how we calculate sign area. And this is a point of clarification based on our experience administering the code. The existing regulations are pretty clear when we're calculating simple geometric shapes, but it gets to be a little bit more complicated when we're dealing with more complex shapes and also dealing with sign backings. So the proposed language and the illustrations help clarify how we calculate sign area. So in the cases on the right where the letters are individually affixed to the building, it shows how we would use the simplest geometric shapes and the number of geometric shapes that are allowed to calculate what that sign area is. And then on the left-hand side where we show different types of sign backings, it's really simple when it's a triangle, but when it's something that's more of a rhombus or just a different type of a shape, we have to figure out how we just geometrically calculate that. So the amendments we're proposing would address that. One other amendment we're proposing is a matter of best practice and just to bring our sign ordinance more in line with what we think is appropriate for the community is to reduce the number of foot candles for each sign. And so as I explained to the board Monday night, foot candles and as John explained, just measuring lighting in general can be a little bit complicated. And it's very conceptual. So the notion of a foot candle, it's that the amount of light that's generated from a light source, the amount of the 1 square foot of surface area that gets illuminated at a distance of 1 foot from the source of the light. So I've tried to provide kind of a visual example of what it looks like when you increase the intensity of foot candles on any given site. Currently, our sign ordinance allows 175 foot candles, which Housiel's firm felt was a little bit high. Current best practice is to allow something more in the range of 100 to 120 foot candles. And since we're reducing it, we opted to reduce it to something more on the high side of the best practice at 120 foot candles. And again, the intent of this is really to just limit how intense the light is coming off of these signs, primarily because we have commercial districts that abut residential zoning districts, and we want to ensure that those two uses remain compatible adjacent to each other. And so we think that controlling lighting intensity is one way to help that.
Lisa, are there any businesses currently that would be impacted by the change in foot candle lighting intensity?
Yeah, there's some of the pylon signs are pretty bright. And so impacted, yes, in that if they were to install a new sign, that new sign would have to be in compliance. But if they have an existing sign that doesn't meet the requirement, it becomes a legal nonconformity. And I'll talk about that in just a moment in terms of the impact that the sign ordinance has when we make these amendments on creating and even furthering or intensifying these legal nonconformities.
Are these pictures labeled correctly? Because it looks like the before is not as bright as the after.
So the before is what happens when the foot candles are a lower intensity, and the after is when they're brighter. So what we're hoping to do is just really reverse this and have it not be quite as intense. But it's just an example I pulled from a lighting manufacturer. And so it's not something that's actually specific to the community, but it shows what happens when you increase the number of foot candles and the effect it can have on a specific area.
Thanks.
Sure. So finally, the language regarding sign ordinance violations is currently limited just to the section on temporary signs. We are recommending that the ordinance be amended by moving that language to another section of the ordinance that would allow the violation language and the enforceability of the ordinance to be applicable to all sign regulations. We also moved banners to temporary signs because the current wording about banners amounted to a content-based regulation, since they were limited to banners that advertised grand openings of stores or commercial businesses. And rather than prohibiting banners, because we know that they're used not only by our business community, but by our institutional partners, we moved them into the temporary sign category. And we've increased the number of banners that are allowed from 2 to 3. Each banner is allowed to be displayed for a 90-day period. And so that is remaining unchanged, but we're just increasing the number of banners that are allowed. And the reason that we're doing that is just quite frankly to try to help our business community out and our institutional partners out in communicating with their constituents and customers, particularly under the current circumstances. So we think it's appropriate to go ahead and allow one more banner a year. So Chairman Neubecker, you raised a good question regarding signs and nonconformities and grandfathering. Signs, there are certain signs that would become nonconforming with the passage of the amended ordinance, and the pylon signs are a good example of that. Signs that were legally erected under the village's current regulations or even the previous regulations before they were amended in 2011, they're allowed to remain in place as a legally nonconforming sign. Legally nonconforming signs are grandfathered and they can be maintained, but once they're removed, they can only be replaced with a conforming sign. And a good example of that is a box sign. So our current regulations prohibit all box signs, but there still are several within the community. When a tenant changes, the landlord is allowed to replace the insert, but once that box sign falls into disrepair or is removed, it can't be replaced with a new box sign. So box signs would be allowed to continue even under the amended regulations, but they would continue on as legal nonconformities. And so the same is true for pylon signs. And again, anything else that doesn't currently comply would be allowed to remain. So with that, I'd like to entertain any additional questions or comments that you have. And at the conclusion of your discussion, we would ask you to make a recommendation that the amended sign regulations be approved by the village board. And with that, I thank you for your time and open it up for your questions and comments.
Thank you, Lisa. You addressed one of the two concerns I communicated earlier to Eric. The grandfathering was something important. I wanted to make sure that a business didn't suddenly find themselves having to incur a significant amount of costs as a result of the change in the ordinance. So the grandfathering addresses that. The second concern I had raised was over potential ambiguity relating to service businesses, such as delivery companies, landscaping companies, plumbers, electricians. Your slide said no vehicle signage. And I think that we need to clarify that because we don't want to have Amazon and FedEx and UPS boycott our deliveries during quarantine time. And my hope is that we can add a clarifying paragraph to the measure that exempts delivery and service businesses from having signage on their vehicles.
Sure, that's a good comment, and I think we can accommodate that. The village has never issued a citation or asked someone to remove a sign or to move a vehicle that has advertising on it. You drive around town and you can see the Scottish Plumber and Homer Tree Care, and we see those. So the intent isn't to prohibit that, but I appreciate the comment so that we can clarify that that's not really what we're talking about. And then when we talk about vehicle and trailer mounted signs, what we're really talking about is quite literally a miniature billboard that's mounted to a trailer and is parked in a commercial area or even in a residential area strictly for the purpose of advertising that business. So John, if you want to weigh in on that, I would ask you to do that. But I appreciate the comments. That wasn't necessarily our intent or our reading of it, but if there's language that's needed to clarify that, we'll certainly work on that.
Yeah, real quickly, Chairman Neubecker, I think the key thing here is we're not prohibiting signs on vehicles. We're prohibiting specifically what we're defining as a vehicle / trailer sign, and that's defined as a sign attached or painted to a vehicle that is parked on or adjacent to any property, the principal purpose of which is to attract attention to a product sold or the business located on that property. So we're not prohibiting signs on vehicles. We expect that almost every commercial vehicle has some kind of signage on it, whether it's service or retail goods or delivery or whatever. The challenge is when someone takes a vehicle, puts a giant sign on it, literally parks it in front of their building as another way to get attention to their business. That's got nothing to do with the fact that it happens to be on a vehicle, except that it is. So the definition relates to and gives staff the ability to interpret this. It says whose primary intent, so it's on a vehicle parked on a site whose primary intent is to draw attention to that site. So it wouldn't affect vehicles.
And John, I did see that section describing that, but there's other parts of the enforcement code where it was more ambiguous. So I think just simply inserting a paragraph that says this shall not restrict service businesses and delivery companies. I mean, the service businesses and delivery companies are clearly not signage for the purpose of boosting a restaurant nearby or a grocery store.
Right.
John, I don't want to nitpick too much, but based on the definition there, you could have a truck that would park in front of the business that would be there. I mean, it would follow within that definition, but that would also move. So maybe something like permanent parking or something like that. I don't want to, again, we might be nitpicking a bit here, but
yeah,
there probably could be language in there.
We'll take a look at that as well. Some of it's going to rely on the consistency of interpretation by administration. We've written several codes. I'll go back and look at the definitions we've used in other codes. The best example I can think of for you is we did Oak Brook several years ago. There was a semi-truck trailer that Room and Board used. It had Room and Board, and they're real big. And it was just parked against the highway in the back of their lot. The rubber was coming off the wheels. It was never used to anything. It was a giant semi-truck. It was just a sign. So, and that gets used a lot by businesses. So that's the intent. But we'll, Chairman Neubecker and Kyler, we'll take a look at that and clean it up.
Great.
Hey, Lisa, thanks for the overview. Two questions. One, you know, understand the concept of existing signage being grandfathered in. But just to be clear, are there any existing businesses that are going to have to make a change or do anything with the new regulations? And then secondly, for new projects that are in development, are they going to have to be reworked in any way to comply with the new signage regulations?
So if there are signs that were installed with a permit from the village, let me break it down into a couple of different categories. if there are signs that were installed that require a permit to begin with, the permit regulations aren't changing. So if you needed a permit before, you need a permit now. If you have a valid permit, a sign that was installed under a valid permit, you don't need to make a change to it. That, if it becomes a legal nonconformity, then that sign is allowed to remain and you don't need to do anything different with it. Now, if you have signs that you installed without a permit and they were supposed to have a permit, it should be taken down, but we tend to take more of a reactive code enforcement stance on signage than we would take a proactive approach. So we know there are some signs in the community that are not already, you know, in compliance. And unless we get a complaint about it or there's some other hazard that's created, we typically, you know, I think window signage, temporary window signage is kind of a good example where we just haven't been real strict about enforcement because we do want to work with the business community. So if there are signs that were installed that don't require a permit and they are in compliance with the current regulations, then no, they would be essentially grandfathered as well. So what we're really talking about are the new signs that are coming in for permit. In terms of existing projects, the only existing project where we're currently dealing with a sign ordinance issue is with the senior living facility at Chicago and Harlem. And so they're under a plan development though. And so there's a little bit different type of a flexibility that they have in seeking relief from the village's regulations. So there's nothing else in the hopper that I'm aware of that would have to rework what they're doing. And typically the way we've treated it in the past too, is if somebody were to come in for a sign permit today, the board hasn't adopted the new regulations. And so if their permit is issued tomorrow, it's under the current sign ordinance and not under the new regulations.
So may I just ask everyone on the committee, subject to adding further clarifications involving service companies and delivery companies, do we have support for this measure to move forward?
Yeah. Hey, this is Tim. I have one comment for John and for Lisa. Can you guys hear me? Sorry.
Yes.
Okay. The only comment I have is when you're starting to teeter a little bit on lighting, and I don't think we want to discourage architectural lighting, you know, tracery lighting, edge lighting. And when you start, I understand, and maybe it's a matter of just having direct examples like you did that, hey, any really bright lights that are tracing around a window are prohibited. But I, you know, we start to get into architectural lighting a little bit, and I want to be careful we don't prohibit, because I think sensitive lighting is good. So I just, that's a one caveat. I don't know, maybe it's, I didn't read the, maybe it's defined in there. So, or maybe as you've done through pictures, to be very clear, we're not allowing this, but we want to encourage architectural lighting.
Yeah, to that point, this is the sign code. So we don't get into accent lighting, architectural lighting, or up lighting. That can really be great. And we have some good examples in the village. So we don't even take a shot at that. I would agree it's appropriate. It's done pretty tastefully. We don't even attempt to regulate that. This gets into the outline lighting for windows. That's it as an advertising or attention getting device only.
Okay.
And then the general brightness, our standards are a lot higher than what was generally accepted as a standard range of lighting. But other than that, we would agree that's not considered signage. So this does not address any of that.
I just don't want somebody flipping, using this to then prohibit some sensitive lighting.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Anyway. I agree 100%. Yep.
And then the only other comment is on the backer boards. I understand the efficiency and the cost savings and the potential reduction of damage to a building or, you know, if the tenant changes. However, pin channel letters against the facade tend to look better. It's just, you know, I hear it, but maybe, and I think we should allow a backer board if it's done properly. I don't know if we want to state a preference. My own thought is we have a preference for individually mounted channel letters, but I think that looks best. That's subjective, but in my own opinion, I think that, you know, but we would allow a backer board if, for whatever. So I don't know if there's a we want to state a preference for aesthetic reasons. So I'll leave that to you.
Yeah, I would agree. And I guess I want to clarify something. I agree 100% as well. The individually affixed letters look infinitely better. It's why codes across the country are rapidly going to this. but in masonry Billings or historic Billings to prevent, and I wouldn't even call it like a backer board. Usually what it is, it's a bar that the letters sort of rest on. It's not a solid plane or geometric shape or a polygon. It's usually a bar at the bottom of the letters or behind the letters, one bar or maybe two. You don't even see it. So it's not a solid plane the letters are affixed to. And if you even go by some of the ones in the village, you'd swear they're individually affixed letters. They're not. They're mounted to a backer bar. And then that bar.
A raceway, right.
Right. So I would agree it should not be a plane or a backer panel, because that's not going to get the same effect, but some other sort of mounting mechanism. We may want to clarify that, because I don't want people to think they can take individually affixed letters, put them onto a backer.
I would.
Agreed. Yeah, I agree. That should be clarified.
Yeah, we can take care of that and more specifically identify mounting mechanisms.
So, if there's no other comments on this, I'd like to move forward. So
one quick thing,
Liz.
One quick thing. Well, unless you were, go ahead. Go ahead.
I just had a question, just with regards to enforcement, and in particular with regards to the lighting. You know, when you start getting into lumens, you know, if somebody's making an application, how will you be evaluating whether it's too bright or not bright enough? I mean, will it be based upon the number of bulbs and the intensity of each bulb? Is somebody going out there with a light meter, or, you know, just how can we manage those businesses that, you know, they might put something that they feel is fine, but then you feel it's too bright? That's very subjective.
Sure. These things all come in for permit. And when they come in for permit, the manufacturer has to provide spec sheets and cut sheets on the products that they're proposing. And so we would evaluate it based on the manufacturer's specifications at that point. Right. If we were to get a complaint afterwards, we would have to go out there with a light meter.
Yeah.
But, you know, in 7 years, I've yet to get a complaint about lighting, but what we don't want to do is start getting complaints about lighting.
Right. Great. Thank you.
Hey, Robert.
Just a quick question on sandwich signs. You indicated, Lisa, that it was only they're only usable on Lake Street. What about Madison Street, thinking ahead, and North Avenue?
North Avenue, I think sandwich board signs, and John, you can jump in with anything I haven't mentioned. With cars going past at a certain speed, the sandwich board signs aren't particularly readable. They're really geared more toward, I think, downtown environments and pedestrian environments, and where vehicles are going past at a relatively slow rate of speed, or in an area where the road is narrow enough and the characteristic of the corridor lends itself to being able to read it. But it's really not intended for motorists. Sandwich board signs are really intended more for pedestrians who are kind of coming upon the shop. So
That's exactly right.
Go ahead, John.
I was going to say it's exactly right. It's usually predicated by the type of a pedestrian environment or a pedestrian oriented environment typically allows them. Usually cities only allow them in their downtowns. And our Village Center area is kind of our downtown, that district. So we're allowing them there. But you typically, North Avenue, I don't think would be a very good idea. And I don't think it's necessarily appropriate on Madison or Harlem. I think if we got them and allowed them as a new thing now, and we saw how they went on Lake Street, we could always amend the code to allow them in other districts as well. But Lisa's right, it's a pedestrian oriented, people walking down the sidewalk oriented type of business district signage. Currently we don't allow it, so it's something new.
Okay.
Does anyone want to make a motion so that we can move forward on this?
So moved as presented with the alterations discussed.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. So moved. Thank you, Lisa, for taking time, and thank you, John.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay. So our next item of business, we've got the discussion, there was a letter to the editor on the Wednesday Journal last week with a resident complaining that Oak Park hadn't really done anything to support the businesses. And I brought that up only as a reminder that we need to think about what can we do to help our restaurants in River Forest that are impacted by new restrictions, and wanted to just get some comments from all of you about your ideas and what we can do to help our businesses.
And while everyone is reflecting on that for a moment, the one thing I will state as well is on Monday night, the board, as normal in terms of our protocol for setting the tax levy for the year, recommended and agreed with the staff recommendation to have a flat village tax levy for the year. So we're not taking our CPI increase, nor are we seeking new construction dollars. So for the village's portion of the levy, for 2020 payable in 2021, that will remain flat. And in some cases, all things being equal, may even go down a little bit. So I only state that because that is something that will not only benefit our residents, but also the business community as well, and everyone who pays property taxes. So certainly not a huge amount of dollars, but still has an impact on everyone. So I wanted to bring that up.
Just for my sake, I'm trying to visually go through the different restaurants that would be impacted by this in the area. You know, I'm just, if you know, you got Bertoli's, they have the cafe next door, and they do a lot of delivery. Like
Grandma Sally's is an example of a restaurant.
Grandma Sally's, yeah. Okay, that's right. I forgot about those over on the Mexican place there.
Panera Bread.
Yeah, that's also that's a conglomerate as well, though. You know, McDonald's, and I mean, it's a local owner there, but.
Well, the Paneras are franchised, so you have, you know.
They're franchised, yeah.
Person that's running the business impacted, so.
Sure.
So I have a question as consumer. I mean, like, businesses mean different things. It could be dining, it could be non-dining businesses too. And dining, you have the big McDonald's versus family-run businesses. I was thinking, I don't know if the other villages are doing it. For example, on Monday, let's do Famous Sally's, if they can do free delivery for everybody who orders between 5 and 8. And we advertise that. Would that help?
That's certainly a nice idea. You know, anything like that.
Yeah, so something, you know, rolling.
We need people who want to get involved and make it happen. So, you know, certainly if you wanted to jump in there and figure out and talk to Grandma Sally's. And
I'm just throwing some ideas. I don't have time for that.
I'm happy to jump in right. So for those who aren't sure, so I'm Liz Holt. I'm with the Oak Park and River Forest Chamber of Commerce. And I guess I echo what Sheba is saying, is that, you know, many, many businesses are struggling right now. In particular, those businesses, I'm sure Donna can speak to this, who do anything with regards to special events, weddings, funerals, family events, etc. So I would encourage everybody to just make sure that we think broadly and not just to those food service businesses. But having said that, Lee, I completely agree. Restaurants are being hit really, really hard. I think it would be great if the village was able to take on some sort of a role in terms of just spreading information.
Advertising, kind of like that, yeah.
Now, look, Eric, I totally get it. You guys are not an advertising company, but you've got the voice. That's the thing. And so if there was any way for, you know, those circulars that are getting pushed out to be able to, you know, just for a short period to take on a role of even an inventory of places to eat, an inventory of businesses that are in the village, you know, if you live in one area of the village, you sometimes forget that, you know, River Forest does extend down to Madison, or if you're down on Madison, you know, like it does extend up to North Avenue. So to just, I guess, just spread the information and remind people. I do also wonder about the, there is a, or what, was it just a one-off thing where people could order food from one of the really lovely restaurants in the city, and then it was like come to the, where the trains, right? So I don't know who organized that, but I do know that that information got pushed out. I mean, I only knew about it because I'm on the emails from coming out of the village. So the village felt that that project was important enough to let me know about it. And I don't live in River Forest, but I'm on those emails. So, you know, that concerns me a little bit that that message is being pushed out for basically non-local businesses. And apparently it was very successful and people loved it, and that's great. But, you know, I'm not suggesting anybody here take on another project like that, but, you know, if you were able to take the time to promote that kind of a thing, then it would be great to promote the businesses. I guess the one last thing I would say is the chamber. So we are the Oak Park River Forest Chamber. We are about to launch to the public a community-wide gift card program. And community-wide can be as loose or as strict as we want it to be. It's Oak Park, River Forest, Forest Park, Berwyn businesses. And this is a gift card program where one gift card can be used throughout the community. So if Donna is a registered retailer or business as part of this program, you can take your gift card and go and buy chocolates, but you could equally go and pay your copay at your doctor's office. You could go to, you know, our Planet Automotive or one of the automotive places and pay to get your car fixed. You know, these days people don't necessarily know what others need. You know, you might think I'm giving you a $100 gift card to go get coffee, but really we're struggling and I need to buy groceries. So we're pushing this out. We'll be, from a marketing point of view, we'll be marketing this heavily to our businesses who will be purchasing client appreciation gifts. So insurance agents, realtors, orthodontists, we want them to keep their spending dollars local. And then when we push out the marketing out to the community, it will be when you're buying those PTO things or a gift for your teacher or even for your, I don't know, babysitter or your grandma because you can't see her, or vice versa, the grandma because they can't see you at Christmas. So I guess if you are able to, and again, the chamber makes note, this is not a profit situation for the chamber. We make no money. We do have, it is a member-based, it's a member benefit. We do have a small fee for non-members to sign up and participate with that. But Eric, if you're happy to use that kind of a marketing point or use your voice to push residents in your community to buy this and stay local. This is really about keeping our money local. And yeah, that does include Panera and it does include McDonald's and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, we just want people, and I know we all love Amazon and we all, et cetera, but if we can keep that money local, that's what we really want to do.
Thanks, yeah, Liz.
Go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, I was just wondering, Eric, if it might be easy for us to put a little bit of money into running some of those video ads we had for River Forest. We've got you covered. I mean, even if we just throw 1,000 at it, it's doing something that might help those businesses.
Absolutely. So a couple things I would say though, in terms of you know, discussing all this. One, the village does understand the challenges right now for you know, local businesses and residents alike. So I think the tax levy item is significant in even if it's just symbolic for some item. In that, here we're not asking you all while you're suffering for more money to maintain our operations here, right? So I think first and foremost, I think that's an important narrative to be thoughtful of. Secondarily, we spent a significant amount of money, earlier on this year when we talked about the We Got You Covered campaign, which was, I think, well received. And those were all local businesses in a way at the time. When a lot of towns weren't doing anything, the village was proactive in terms of trying to help its business community. So we could certainly go back and take a look at that again. I would want to revisit those metrics and those costs just to understand that before we would necessarily commit to anything. And then your last point about promoting businesses, we're always happy to do that. And if there are ways or ideas or programs that the chamber is running, we are more than happy to advocate that and push those things out as well, because we want to be supportive of the committee, the business community, and those are obviously very low cost things, if no cost. So Liz, if you and I want to talk about what you think it would be helpful from the chamber's perspective. I think we've worked long enough to know that we're always happy to do that. And
right.
I hope that our past performance in these issues would give everyone an indication on future performance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, things like we at the chamber, we've got a COVID safety pledge that we encourage businesses to take, and then they can at least then put that on their website and their social media. We've got one page on our website that lists all the businesses in both villages that have taken the pledge. So something like that, I am happy to send that to you, and you can send that out and say, look, these are all the businesses that have taken the pledge to be safe for you. It's just good, positive marketing, and it reinforces that stay local thing. Which is, I think, that's all we can do right now.
And
I think that's a great idea. And Erica, on top of that, when we do send that information out, I think it'd be important to recognize what we've done already. I think it'd be great not just for the people in this call or in a circle to hear that information, but for all the residents to kind of get the understanding that, what River Forest is trying to do with these different actions. I think that'd be important and goodwill building for the village.
So picking up off that, Kyla, is maybe Liz or Eric can answer this question. So there's a section of people who get the information on social media, and there's a huge section who get from print media. So we want to target both.
Yeah.
And the print media people could be the older ones, and we want them to be safe at home. So how do we get them involved as well and realize what's out there?
Yeah, the village, in terms of, again, resources are finite. So I have to be careful. So as we hold our line on the tax levy, because that's the right thing to do, as village administrator, I also have to be mindful of expenses. So everyone knows, it's a balancing act, right? And so the one thing that we did early on, though, is we sent a letter to every senior citizen in town regarding our COVID senior care program. So senior citizens are those who are either disabled or have other high risk issues, received the letter from the village with our hotline number and the ability to contact us and our volunteer coordinator if they needed assistance. So we've been proactive with that early on and have been continuing to promote that through our e-news, et cetera. So those, I think the village has done fairly well in terms of communicating with that particular population. And then the good news is, in terms of the emails and the Facebooks and the other social medias, there's a very low cost, no cost to that in terms of getting that word out.
So Liz, what about the Oak Park River Forest Chamber of Commerce? I've seen ads in Wednesday Journal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's our primary way of getting print media information out.
And that's good enough, because I think the population we're talking about do read Wednesday Journal.
Yeah, they do.
Liz, one thought I had that you might want to consider, if you can run with it, is embracing your members to do a campaign for order, or carry out for Thanksgiving, and having restaurants feature different things, and maybe you know, if we're featuring our restaurants like Grandma Sally's and whatnot, you know, they might have an opportunity to do Thanksgiving to go or just the sides. Many people want to cook their turkey and ham, but you have all these side dishes. And so that could be a simple way that the community can support the restaurants.
Yeah.
But, you know, that really requires someone to run with it. And with this COVID test event right now, I'm kind of at my capacity for doing things. But I certainly think that if someone wanted to spearhead a campaign, you know, the village could probably support that initiative with an email blast or something encouraging people to order.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I will let people know that our chamber since probably May, every 2 weeks, we do a takeout, we call it a takeout stakeout on Friday at lunch. And we go to a member restaurant and we literally flood them with lunch orders, local businesses. We've got several businesses that just buy lunch for the whole office. I think Eric, you and John and joined us when we were at the Sugar Beet Schoolhouse a few weeks ago. So, I mean, I would encourage people, if there's any businesses here that you, if you really do want to support them, you know, come along to these events. We usually infuse the business with $400 to $500 at a lunchtime, which is, that's a really big infusion at a lunch. So, you know, that's how we're committed to doing that. We're not too sure if we'll extend that out to the community. Again, our chamber resources are finite and, you know, as the businesses struggle, so do we struggle. So we have to be very careful as well about, I mean, what we do is similar to what Eric said, we have to balance. But please do come out to those. I can send that information to Eric as well. Maybe I can send it out to this group if people want to start joining us.
Liz, I made a quick list of 8 or so eateries we have here in River Forest. Are any of them members of the chamber?
You know, not the eateries. I mean, they just really aren't. Mm-hmm. No.
And I find it interesting that even in our group alone, we probably can't name all 8. So I don't know that our residents really know a lot of these places are even here. And
Get
the word out that we have these places can get carry out would be helpful. I don't know how to get that word out. But.
Well, can I just say the gift card program that we've got, it is, and again, I can send the link. It's right off of our homepage at oprfchamber.org. But that has one of those maps. So, you know, they're like a geo-registered map. And so if you scroll down, where can I spend my gift card? It's got a map. And I would love it if that map had all of those restaurants on it. Then it would be really easy to see where you could shop and spend your money in River Forest.
So do you approach these restaurants to join the program?
Well, I haven't yet because we're trying to get our members signed up first.
And what is the fee for a non-member to join?
Non-member fee is $150 to be as part of that program for a whole year. So as soon as we start marketing out to the community, that's where they're going to get that marketing. Even if nobody ever came and spent their gift card in their place, they'll get a whole year of marketing. Mm-hmm. And of course, right now we'll be doing, you know, the holiday gift guide. And then, you know, in the new year, it's going to be about, you know, Valentine's Day and then Easter and whatever. So we will just use it as a marketing campaign and we will just use those businesses that are signed up to be part of that that card.
Yeah, well, thank you for your comments, Liz. Okay. We've got, I'd like to try to have our meeting wrap up by 9, but we still have some business that needs to be covered. A quick update on the River Forest, We've Got You Covered campaign. Eric, did you have any metrics or details on what happened in terms of sales after that campaign ran? I know we were going to be delayed in being able to measure that.
Yeah, no, we've previously sent along the social media type metrics on that. Again, it's difficult outside of the anecdotal information that we did receive when we talked about it a couple months ago. I know Jackie from La Perlita was on the call, had shared her own personal experience with how her business had certainly an increase on that because of that push. But there's really it's difficult otherwise to pin down an actual dollar amount.
Okay. And is there any other business we need to cover?
No.
Okay. And then we have something for executive session. So thank you for everyone who was able to attend and comment as guests. I appreciate your participation. There's some executive session business that we have to cover. So we'll have to ask that anyone that isn't on the board for the EDC to drop off now so that we can do that. But first, is there a motion to move into executive session?
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Katie.
Yep. So real quick, Liz Holt, maybe you and I just later on today, we can connect and just chat quick.
Yep.
Yeah. So we would need a motion to adjourn into executive session to discuss acquisition of real property and sale of real property. And we will not, after the meeting, there will be no other business and no other reporting out. So once executive session concludes, we will be adjourning the meeting. So I'll need a motion to that effect.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.